Hey everybody, this is Brian coming at you from late 2022. You're about to listen to one of the original episodes of the Internet History Podcast, a project I started way back in 2014. It eventually became a book called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone, written by me, but these are the original chapters and interviews I did for that book. So here you have all the original oral history interviews, the original players of the internet era in their own words. You'll get hours more detail and stories here than I was able to even fit in the book. If you like this podcast, buy the book, but also the podcasts stand on their own. Almost 300 hours of original source material of internet history. They've been downloaded about 3 million times over the years. And if you like what you hear here, search and subscribe to What I Do Today, the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast, a daily tech news podcast I've been doing since 2018. Basically, the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast is the history of the internet every day in real time.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. In honor of the upcoming 20th anniversary of Netscape's founding, we're reaching out to several of the founding employees of the company to help us tell the Netscape story. Today, we're going to be talking to Lou Montulli. Lou was a co-founder of ePinions.com and the co-founder and CEO of Memory Matrix, which was purchased by Shutterfly. He is currently the chief scientist at the online backup company Zeta.net. But 20 years ago, he was employee number 9 and a founding engineer at Netscape Communications Corporation.
Welcome.
Yeah, so Lou Montulli, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
So you were born in D.C., is that right?
I was actually born in Los Angeles. My father was in the Air Force for 23 years. We moved all over the country. Was in Los Angeles, Albuquerque, Ohio, New York. Ended up 8 years in Washington, D.C., just outside Washington, D.C., in Fairfax, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I did my early schooling there through the beginning of high school, and my father retired at that point, and we moved to Wichita, Kansas. So I ended up in Kansas for my final years of high school, and ended up going to the University of Kansas after that.
That was my next question, how you ended up at University of Kansas. I'm assuming your degree was computer science?
It was originally electrical and computer engineering, and then I switched to computer science a few years in because I felt it better suited what I was passionate about.
So is that where you got interested in the internet or the web in general at that point?
Yeah, so I was working at the university computer center, and originally I came in and was changing tapes and doing a lot of menial chores, and I kind of worked my way up to doing computer support and helping professors and students figure out computers in general. A lot of silly questions, a lot of interesting ones. And we had an ongoing project that had been kind of sitting on the back burner for a couple of years, which was to create a online information source. This was kind of the emerging time when putting information out on the network was starting to become possible. And at the time, the state of the art was either FTP, which was, you know, very text oriented, or this program called Gopher. And Gopher was kind of the first easy to use way of accessing network, accessing information over the network. But its major limitation was that it simply provided a list of data. You'd go to one page and it would provide 5 or 10 choices that were numbered, and you'd choose the number, and you would go down through a series of lists, and it would get to a final document format, and that document might be text or something else, images, other things. There wasn't PDF or any of those sorts of things around at that time. There was Word documents and Excel documents and that sort of thing, the very basic kind of computer documents that we know of today. And I set out to work on this project somewhat accidentally. I'd seen this product called HyperRes, which was a local hypertext browser, which I became fascinated with. I'd never seen hypertext before that, and saw that it was a really interesting medium for connecting documents together. And I thought that this was a much better method for browsing documents than Gopher. And so I started a project, really a prototype project, where I merged the user interface of HyperRes to Gopher, which was a way of getting to the documents over the network. And I created the product called Lynx in a prototype for them in a couple of days by kind of merging these two separate programs together. And started working on the Lynx project. I got a go-ahead from the management at the computer science at the computer center there to work on it, and we started working on that for about a year and created a hypertext program that used Gopher as the back-end network protocol. So about a year into this, started hearing about this other project that Tim Berners-Lee was working on and that Mark Andreessen was working on simultaneous called the Web, which essentially did the exact same thing, but used different protocols. So it used HTML and HTTP instead of Gopher and, you know, basically this really primitive hypertext format, which I had come up with. So we've been essentially working on very similar things in parallel. And I realized that an ecosystem is stronger when you have multiple people working on it. So what I did is I took links and added the capability for it to process HTTP and HTML, and then had something that was that worked within the ecosystem of what was being called the web at that point.
And but at this point, it's always, when I find it in articles, it's always referred to as a text-only browser. So it gains browser capability, but it's still at this point text-only. Is that right?
Yeah, which was the web was text only at that point as well.
Right.
There was no images. There was nothing else. So the actual interface for Lynx is on terminal systems. So it's rare to have terminals that can provide image capability. So you might see that on X Windows, which is a terminal as well.
Right.
But most of the users for Lynx were on text terminals through PCs and other kind of, at that time there was a lot more VT100 displays and that sort of thing connected to mainframes, VAX systems, Unix systems, that sort of thing. In fact, at the time that that the web really started to take off, we don't really have strong numbers for this, but I think Lynx was probably the most used program on the web at that time because people actually had access to it. It was really popular among universities, and students at that time generally had access to computers via mainframe and PCs connected to mainframe computers because it was rare to have a regular PC connected to the internet that could have a standalone web browser to it.
Yeah, I actually don't have it in front of me, but I did. I found a link to something that was estimating the size of browser usage, I guess, a year into Mosaic, and Lynx was still right up there with Mosaic at that point, at least according to the estimate. So,
yeah, and also the first version of Mosaic was X Windows, and almost nobody has X Window access.
Right. Exactly. So
hacker.
And Mosaic didn't really, I mean, Mosaic was popular on X Windows, but it didn't really take off until the Mac and Windows versions came out. Is that correct?
Exactly. What Mosaic was incredibly beautiful platform that showed the potential of the web. And so seeing on X Windows gave it a lot of pizzazz, and people could get excited about that. And then as the ecosystem filled in, the other browsers, Lynx, Cello, Mac Mosaic, and Win Mosaic helped give people access to it all over the world. Because as I said, very few people had X Windows terminals.
So at this point, are you have you crossed paths with the NCSA guys and Berners-Lee on message boards and forums and things like that?
Yeah, as soon as I saw the release of X Mosaic from Mark, I realized the potential for me immediately was I wouldn't have to write this X Windows version, because ironically I was working on an X Windows version of Lynx at that exact same time, so the timing was kind of perfect. And I said, well, if Mark's written this thing, I don't need to write another version, save myself a bunch of time. So I reached out to him early on, and we started communicating fairly regularly within a few months' time. As I was working, so at the time the web protocols and such were supported by an open source library that came out of the web project that Tim Berners-Lee was running at CERN, and so we were essentially using the same open source libraries, and I started working on those libraries pretty extensively to improve their support for various other protocols like FTP, Waze, and other things. And so Mark and I were communicating kind of constantly on improving the library and making the back-end support for these protocols much better.
Yeah, and actually a lot of archives of those messages are online if you hunt around for them. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, there's a message board called www-talk.
Right, exactly.
Which was the first one, and then there was another one, because that one got really popular among kind of the general populace, and so we created another one for developers only, which was a little bit more exclusive, not like something you'd really want to be on necessarily, but just for the people who are actively working on the development of the code.
Right. So then the first time that you would have met Mark or any of the Mosaic guys was at the Web Developers Conference in Cambridge in 93?
Absolutely, yes, and that was sponsored by O'Reilly. It was a great opportunity for us to get together, discuss some topics that had been somewhat controversial, and move the ball forward.
Was one of those controversies the whole idea of adding images to the web?
Yeah, there was a definite schism between us young kids and especially Tim Berners-Lee, who wanted to keep the web essentially lowest common denominator all the time. I wouldn't say that he was opposed to adding images and other things, but he was opposed to the kind of the methodology in which it was going about. Wanted to make sure that everything was accessible, and so we had a bunch of discussions around that at the conference and came up with some, interesting ideas. That's where the idea of alt text came from, of adding textual descriptions of the images so that could be shown in place, or as it's used as the tooltip. We also, wouldn't know this now, but back then the HTML was incredibly primitive in terms of what it could actually mark up, and there was no way to even do a line break. I remember we added the line break, the BR tag at that point, which is, it's hard to imagine that it never existed, but it really was, there wasn't any really presentation markup in HTML at that time, because Tim, coming from the HTML world, had wanted to add essentially style sheets early on. It was just style sheets being so complicated were wasn't necessarily a practical thing to do very quickly.
So Mosaic takes off, and Is there any discussion about maybe merging Lynx and Mosaic, or maybe you heading over to the NCSA or anything like that, or are you still staying in Kansas at this point and developing Lynx on your own?
Yeah, I was still in Kansas developing it on my own. We brought on another staff member who was working on a version of Lynx for DOS, and we released that. I never considered going to NCSA. The working relationship that we had over email was certainly working fine, and things were also developing very rapidly. Mark left the project fairly quickly and moved to California. I was close to graduating, so I was planning my exit regardless. Certainly one could see that the popularity was taking off and that there was a commercial potential for things in the future. I had always in the back of my mind, even at the beginning of the project, thought, well, I'm releasing this thing so that I can gain some exposure and experience so that I can go on and actually get a job, because eventually you need to make some money. I didn't know it was going to be starting a company, but I knew that it was going to be something in the tech career.
So that leads us to who gets in touch with you start the recruiting process for Netscape? Is it Mark or Jim Clark? Or actually, well, before you answer that, Jim Clark says in his autobiography that you were at a racquetball tournament in Kansas City or something. So they contact you and you fly out?
Yeah, so I was at the Intercollegiate National Racquetball Tournament down in Arizona, and it's a week-long tournament. So I came back from that and had an email waiting for me. This was back before you could check email on your phone. I had actually a phone message. I think it was just a phone message, not an email. Maybe it was an email as well, but I ended up calling Jim back, got his personal assistant instead of Jim, and it was basically the message was Jim and Mark are going to fly out to Illinois and want to talk about starting a company. We'd like you to join him there, they were going to meet the very next morning, and this was, you know, like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so. Basically, I just gotten flown in from Arizona, came from the airport to the office, so I got back into my car, drove back to the airport, and bought a ticket to Illinois on the next flight out, which was a little stressful. As a college student, I don't know how close you are.
Right, I was going to say, no. Yeah, I would hope they'd at least reimburse you or something.
Yeah. I mean, the most I'd ever made in salary at that point was like $8,000 a year. So basically living check to check. And I remember asking his assistant, so are you sure that Jim can reimburse me on this? Because I really don't have the kind of money that I can just hop on get a flight on the same day, because they're always, you know, three or four times as expensive.
Right.
Fortunately my credit card had enough on it that I could get the flight, and I actually ended up beating Jim and Mark out there because they get stuck in a snowstorm, so got there a few hours ahead of them.
So the legend is that they do the interviews and the recruiting pitch at a pizza joint or something like that. What do you remember how that went down?
I think we were actually in the hotel lobby, or not the lobby, but they're kind of lounge, if I remember correctly. It is a little hazy, so I wouldn't contradict what they said. But we basically got together and started talking about, you know, what we could do, and the idea of creating a company around commercializing the web. And, you know, this is what we've been doing for the last couple of years. So there was certainly no disagreement. Mostly we were talking about potential and how awesome it would be. And then we did have individual meetings with Jim. It's hard to say whether what the purpose of that was. I think Jim was selling us, and also trying to make sure that all of us weren't a little crazy, because it's the first time he was meeting us. So there was definitely some selling going on, Jim talking about things which to our starry eyes seemed kind of incredible and unbelievable. But he, you know, he's a very convincing guy and passionate. And so I remember walking out of that meeting just being incredibly excited about the opportunity and how wonderful things were going to be in the beautiful land of California.
Well, right. I was going to say, I mean, there was no hesitation on your part. I mean, you know, today, you know, kids leave college, go out to California and you know, dream of becoming billionaires and stuff. And I know, you know, Netscape wasn't the first startup of startups, but, you know, the template for going out and starting a web company, you guys made that template. So there wasn't a little bit of hesitation there. You were just excited. Do you remember what you felt like about that?
Well, for me, the opportunity was just at a perfect time, perfect opportunity. I was already out job hunting. I'd done several interviews at Intel and other places, and I had gotten some really good offers, I mean, way beyond what I thought I was going to be making right out of college. I mean, back then, a fantastic job out of college would be $30,000. You know, I was stoked. People were offering me, you know, double that. How could this be? This is fantastic. So the future felt really bright. But I did really, really love what I was doing on the web, and the idea to continue working on that with a luminary from the industry and the folks that I knew were already great programmers and could really pull off something amazing was, I never had a second thought about that. It was everything lined up. This was just the perfect opportunity at the perfect time. So it was never a question in my mind that I wouldn't go do that.
So actually, jumping ahead to California then, so from day one, is the plan to do a better browser, or was it still sort of up in the air? You were going to do something on the web, but you didn't know what it was yet. Or was the browser the plan from day one, is my question.
The browser was the plan from day one. So maybe some of the confusion there is that when Jim and Mark first met, they were throwing around a bunch of other ideas because Jim had done some really interesting things with on-demand television and some things with Nintendo and some other interesting projects. But eventually they came to their senses and realized that the web really was the right opportunity. So by the time we got in Illinois,
the browser kind of seems like it was the obvious step for them too, because you know they already know how to do this. They're going to get the band back together.
Exactly. So by the time we came together in Illinois, there was really only the focus to do something on the web. So there was two efforts there. We knew we were going to lead with the browser. So the plan was certainly to wholly recreate a new browser ground up with stability, performance, and targeted towards the average consumer and average computer. So make it available to everybody and make a great product that everybody wants to use. And then the only kind of question that was remaining is how to really make money on this thing. And so there was a lot of discussion about what we're actually selling. And they eventually arrived at the model that we would create servers as well and sell the servers and give the client away for free. So essentially the razor and razor blades model.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Right. And so was that something that was that strategy worked out from the top? I'm curious to know about, like, well, first of all, like, what was your job title at that point?
Almost all of us were just MTS, member of the technical staff. We were engineers, right. And none of us really were that concerned about titles. We basically made up our own titles on our business card, that sort of thing.
Right. So that's sort of my question. You know, the way the NCSA guys describe it, you know, coming up with different features, you know, coming up with new things to add to the next version. They're sort of kicking it around bull session style. Is that how Netscape was at the beginning, or?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a very open and collaborative process. Everybody has a voice, and the general consensus was the best ideas will rise to the top, and you argue passionately for what you believe in, and just continue to make forward progress. So there not a lot of formal planning. Meetings and that sort of thing. Essentially, we were moving so insanely fast, we would have these impromptu meetings when we hit particular roadblocks that would discuss the issue and try to really wring it out and then just move forward. So a lot of times you'd get to an implementation issue and then you'd just grab some people. It might even be 10 o'clock at night, grab bunch of people, go, you know, yell at each other for a while, as we like to say. It's usually more cordial than that. Come up with an idea, and then, you know, you start implementing it right away. So we didn't have traditional product management. We didn't have a team of people that were, you know, off in a corner deep thinking. The advantage that we had was that we had all been there at the very beginning and had spent years, you know, working on the web. So we had all this experience already, and were able to make experienced decisions quickly, which led to possibly, you know, certainly in my life, the greatest and fastest explosion of code and ideas that I've ever seen. I mean, it was amazing. All these people coming together with great ideas, had worked on this area for many years, and had already produced something very similar, i.e. another web browser. Here we're recreating a new web browser from scratch, but along similar principles. We're able to move.
By the way, was that an edict that, you know, we can't use any of the old Mosaic code, we've got to do everything completely from the ground up?
Absolutely, yes. The idea was to sell this thing, so we needed to create something that wouldn't be encumbered by any other copyright or commercial problems. So made sure that we started clean and just moved forward.
And what were you specifically working on? Was it the browser side or the server side?
I was the weird one because I was doing had a little bit of a hand in both. I was doing all the cross-platform networking code and back-end databases and the communication flow within the browser. So if you think about, there was essentially three parts to each browser. And when I say each browser, I mean we had 17 different platforms to support. We had Windows, we had Mac, and we had 11 versions of Unix, and then within Windows and Mac, there was different versions, 64 and 32-bit and other things. So they all looked like a lot of different browsers in some ways. So there was front-end code, which was the user interface. There was low-level code, which was how the operating system interacts with various networking libraries and that sort of thing. That was the responsibility of the front-end teams. And then there was the HTML interpreter, if you will. It was the parser and how it interfaced with the UI elements on the screen. And that was written by Eric Bina. And then everything else that was cross-platform nearly, excuse me, I was writing. So the networking code, the things like bookmarks, databases, history, caching, those sorts of things, settings, That's the stuff I was working on.
So at this point, what's Mark Andreessen's role? He's sort of hovering in general, you know, giving the marching orders or just keeping everyone marching in the same direction. What's his role at this point?
Well, I think the plan was for him to be kind of a technical leader when we started. And he started in that role, trying to basically say we're going to go, you know, he was trying to make kind of a technical roadmap. The reality was he quickly got kind of consumed with a whole lot of other stuff going on, especially the public relations effort and the ability to work with other companies. So we saw him a fair amount in the first month or two, and he would come to engineering meetings and such. But then we didn't see him a whole lot after that. He got really, really busy doing other stuff not directly related to the client and the server team.
Mm-hmm. And Jim Clark, too, is he not necessarily there on a day-to-day basis? He's out hiring people and things like that?
Yeah, well, Jim was key in building the relationships, hiring a pretty massive team early on, because as we felt that the client and server were on track, Jim was smart enough to recognize, well, we need to build out these other services. So he started working on building out a product called the Merchant Server. Which was something that could sell, actually do commerce on the web, so shopping cart model, various other things. So it was a server specifically designed to help you provide commerce on the web, which was different than our content server, and also fundraising and other things. Having now been through that process many years on, I know how time consuming that is, and Jim really executed that very, very well.
So you guys are able to get the beta version of Navigator out in what, 6 months?
Let's see, it was May 2nd. Essentially, we were code complete about the end of August, mid-September. I think the original beta came out like at the very early part of October. I'm correct. That was 20 years ago, so hard to remember exactly. But that is about 6 months, yeah, which is ridiculously fast considering how complex and how much code was there.
And then you had the server was out a couple months after that too, right? So then, you know, right away the business plan is in place.
Yeah, I mean, technically we were hosting off the server right away, but yeah, we didn't release the server probably. That was on a different release plan commercially for a little while, but technically it went out at the same time the client did, because we were hosting off of it ourselves.
So are you guys able to feel, you know, the rocket ship start to take off, in the sense that are you aware of how popular Navigator gets? I mean, it's obviously a year, 2 years on from when you're doing things like Lynx and Mosaic, so the web itself is bigger, but, you know, what did it feel like once you finally get it out there and, you know, it's starting to really take off?
Well, we didn't have a long space between it. Essentially, we're working on Lynx and Mosaic one day, and then we go to California, start working on Netscape the next day. So we had about 6 months when we were just heads down working on our new implementation, but we were
ironically at that point the web is doubling in size every 2 months, so even that 6 month period the web's way bigger than it was previous. So
right, so but we were still very much involved in the web development community, because one of our tenants coming from the open source community at the university was to try to keep this whole thing open. That was a very important part of who we were and how our culture was. So when we came up with new ideas, we put them out to the web community rather than just say, hey, this is our idea, we're gonna just run with this. So we had the idea that we wanted to continue to be open and wanted to make everything we did be part of the future standard. So when we came up with new ideas, we put them out there and said, hey, this is a cool idea, and this is how we're thinking of doing it. What do you guys think? And we would get feedback. We would change what we were doing if people have better ideas, and just generally try to put forth stuff in a way that other people can use it.
Well, like SSL, right? Like, you guys worked to develop that, but you immediately put it out there for everybody.
Exactly. But the tenet was it's only useful if everyone can use it, and that this rising tide makes everything go up. So that's not the metaphor I was looking for, but close enough. I know there's a good metaphor in there, but I've forgotten it. So SSL is a good example. There had been a lot of talk about these other encryption technologies and things that weren't going anywhere. We knew that in order for the web to succeed, that people needed to trust it. We wanted commerce to explode on the web, but without security and trust, people aren't going to buy anything. So we felt we had to put out the best possible security software, and the best way to get everyone to use it is to give away an implementation completely free. So we made a reference implementation, gave the code away, and worked really hard to make it as good as it could be.
So you guys are all in your 20s at this point, so you're routinely pulling the legendary 30, 40, 50-hour coding days and sleeping under your desk and that sort of thing?
It's bad. I was thinking recently about what my diet was back then, essentially like 10 Mountain Dews, full strength, no diet, some horrible food. I think my regular schedule back then would be to come in, work for about 20 hours straight. We had a futon room, which is a little disturbing to think about now, but it was a mattress in a conference room that was dark. And I would catch about 4 or 5 hours of sleep at the office, wake up and do another 20 hours, and then go home and sleep for like 12 or 15 hours, mm-hmm. and start the whole cycle again.
to be 20 again, right?
Exactly. Well, one of the things about that time that made it special was we had the design pretty well figured out because we'd already written it before. So there was a great deal of actual coding to be done. Typically, when you're in a company, especially a new company, a startup, you spend a lot of time thinking very deeply about what the product should be and about certain design constraints, because this is the first time you've written a product like that. So we had a unique situation where they had a ton of work to be done that just needed to get done. And so you really could work that hard and be productive. I wouldn't recommend doing that to your average startup. And unfortunately, a lot of startup people think that that's the way it should be done because of all the publicity we had. But we had a very special circumstance. So to all the young coders out there, if they're listening, that's not a great way of getting work done in a smart, intelligent coding methodology.
Yeah, you know, that's funny. When I, you know, have been doing the research on this, it is funny how much of the lore of how the Netscape environment was has become sort of like the template for the startup. I mean, even going back to, you hear stories of these chair football games and having competitions with remote control cars and work hard, play hard, you know, sleep under your desk, that sort of thing. It's almost like startup culture took what you guys did and used it as a model, you know?
Yeah, and unfortunately the startup culture was defined by the press, and the press just take whatever they think is most interesting, juicy, and fascinating out of their limited time, and they publicize that. So it was especially post Netscape in 1998, 1999, every startup was trying to do the things that they read about in the magazines, but what they read about in the magazines was nowhere near the reality of what Netscape was. That was just what the popular media thought it was, because that's what they were taking out of their limited time and publicizing.
Well, and not only that, but the whole get big fast thing. I know that that's a Jeff Bezos line, but you know, the whole strategy of let's get out there, get ubiquitous, and we'll worry about money later. You know, again, especially in the .com days, that was the playbook.
Well, it's my understanding that that's still a reasonable economic model, right? First mover advantage.
Right.
There's a lot of economists who will still support that model. It does matter your industry, certainly, whether or not that's a viable model, but certainly with a lot of technology, a lot of different technologies that have switching costs, getting to users first gives you a big advantage because the consumer doesn't want to go try something different after they're locked into something they like.
So do you have memories of the IPO?
Right. The IPO, certainly a positive time in the history of the company. Honestly, it was not a huge event for most of us because at that time we were still really, really heads down working on the browser and other Netscape products. And the company was trying not to make it a distraction. I certainly remember not putting any thought at all into it prior to the day of IPO. Woke up on the morning of the IPO and was obviously shocked to see what had happened and see the run-up and the just really ridiculous, amazing thing. But I spent about a day thinking about it and then quickly got back to work. Certainly there was the thought in my mind that now there's a hell of a lot of money available to my bank account, but worked really hard, and the whole company from the top down was really focused on saying, let's not let this become a distraction. Let's keep the main thing, as Barksdale likes to say, and know that that price, that valuation is dependent on the work we're going to continue to do. So if we don't keep the buses running on time, if we don't keep working hard, that's not going to mean anything. So there was a celebration, there was a party, they were relatively fast affairs, and everybody got right back to work and worked hard and tried not to let that become a big distraction. It wasn't really until a fair amount of time later when liquidity kicked in and some other events happened that, you know, really dawned on any of us that, well, we've got a lot of money.
The Porsches start showing up in the parking lot.
Honestly, the Porsches didn't really show up until we started acquiring other companies. The founders, the initial crew from NCSA and I and some others, we kept each other very grounded. None of us bought any fancy cars. We kind of joked that we were going to drive beaters for the rest of our lives just to disprove the whole myth that you have to become nouveau riche. So most of us drove very reasonable cars for many, many years. I didn't buy my first fancy car until after I'd left Netscape. And we tried to keep each other just grounded and focused, knowing that those sorts of things are merely distractions in our life. And what made us special, what made us great, was their ability to have these technical achievements. And if we give that up, what are we?
You left Netscape in, is it 98, to do ePinions? Is that right?
Yeah, I left at the end of 98. Right as the acquisition, AOL acquisition.
Okay, happened. Right. That was my next question. In retrospect, historically it goes down to everyone says Netscape got crushed underfoot by Microsoft, the browser wars, and all that stuff. Do you feel like that there was anything Netscape did wrong, could have done differently? Again, looking back on it 15 years later, I don't know how that much time gives you a perspective on that sort of thing, but what were you guys aware that that Microsoft was coming for you, and then and things were starting to get bad at some point?
Absolutely, yeah. It was hard to escape, unfortunately. And you know, back in those days, I had a fair amount of anger about the whole thing. I will preface some of this as saying that you know, Microsoft was eventually found guilty of significant malfeasance, and it was largely because of the pressure that we brought to bear. And it was unfortunate that we had to be the victim of that. It was also pretty sad to see the next administration come in and essentially dismiss all of the penalties against the company. The net result was, as Netscape grew, we diverted from our original business model a little bit because people really wanted to pay us for the client. And so we started to generate a substantial amount of licensing revenue from the client, from businesses, especially Fortune 500 businesses. They were paying us a lot of money. We were still selling the server, but we were also selling a significant amount of the browser. About somewhere close to half of our revenue was coming from that. And we used that money to grow the company very quickly and start to diversify. What Microsoft did was they had a strategy to essentially take away all of our revenue on the client side. And so they originally said, well, we'll just give the browser away for free. And they tried that for a couple of versions. So they originally bought a version of the browser from Spyglass. And put that out and then started working on their own. And they tried to give away their browser for free for a really long time, and nobody would take it because it wasn't particularly good software. Now, over time, they improved their software, but they still weren't getting a lot of traction in giving it away for free. So they started essentially paying people to start using their browser. There was many, many examples where we would close a big deal or be close to closing a big deal, and we'd find out that that no, we're not really going to get the money from that deal because somebody from Microsoft came in and offered to buy a division of that company for an obscene profit so that that large company would start using Microsoft browser instead of our browser. So instead of us getting $20 or $30 million on that deal, that company got paid $20 or $30 million to not use us. That's a little disheartening, but we were still doing well. We still had 90% of the market and making traction. The biggest single event that really triggered the downfall of our company was the switch of the AOL browser from Netscape to Internet Explorer. At that time, AOL was 35% of the internet traffic, because a lot of people in the U.S. Were on AOL dial-up, and they don't get a choice. They get whatever browser AOL was giving them, and they were using our browser because it was the best. This is all well publicized. Microsoft offered AOL a place on the desktop if they would switch, and that's worth billions of dollars. And the illegality there was that's tying one monopoly to another business, and it's what Microsoft was found guilty of abusing at that time. But what it really did was it changed the nature of the browser percentages. So it went from 90% Netscape to more like 65 to 70% Netscape, essentially overnight. And what that meant was that the content producers, the guys creating all of the content on the web, before would just write new features for Netscape, and it meant that we always had a lead. We continue to come out with new software, and that was better and better. And when 30% of the internet is now suddenly Internet Explorer, now that all the content guys are saying, oh well, now we have to pay attention to Internet Explorer. Now we have to create content that works equally good in both. And what that did was it made us a commodity. And when you're a commodity, i.e. you can use either and it doesn't really matter, then you're going to lose to the big fish in town. In order for a small company to succeed against a big company, you have to have a product advantage, you have to have uniqueness and differentiation. And once you become a commodity, then all you can do is give it away for free or have it cheaper. You can't be cheaper than what Internet Explorer was, which was free and coming with everything else. So making us a commodity essentially meant the death of our client business, which meant, for all intents and purposes, we were now no longer the mover and shaker on the internet anymore.
Even despite the fact that most of your revenue isn't coming from the client, it's coming from the servers.
Right, but 50% of our revenue was from the client, and to switch 50% of your revenue in 1 year is a Herculean task. You know, it put insane pressure on us, and we started behaving a little bit dysfunctionally. The company decided it wanted to become a groupware company all of a sudden, and so we're suddenly focusing efforts on email and other kinds of groupware features, which is very distracting from our primary mission, which was web browsers and the web itself. I think in retrospect, it would have been much better to stay focused on just the web. Clearly, there's revenue there.
Right.
But at the time, we were scrambling because we were under intense financial pressure. Once you grow, it's very hard to shrink back down. You know, budgets only go up, should only go up in most cases. So it became very, very difficult. You know, we certainly had our share of other interesting challenges that at the time felt, you know, really serious. But in my retrospect, having been 20 years in the industry right now, we were still doing a lot of things really, really well as a company, as an engineering company, other things. Could have done them better, but certainly in a normal company, none of the things that we were doing badly would have killed the company. As our client revenue shrank, we were under intense financial pressure, and the company started to have this really kind of doom and gloom in it, especially at the beginning of 1998 when we had to do layoffs and other things.
You said earlier you were bitter about it for a long time. Do you feel slightly differently about it now?
Well, time has healed those wounds. But I was, you know, I was really, really angry at Microsoft and Bill Gates in particular for essentially killing the company that I had helped create and put all my blood, sweat, and tears into. And I get why they did it. They felt threatened. But at least if they'd done it fairly, I would have felt a little bit better about it. I probably still would have been pretty angry. But to know that they had broken the law to do it, to know that they were essentially... You know, as I felt then, they were taking food from the mouth of my children. Mm-hmm. It was really made me angry. They set out specifically to kill our company, and that I think that would make anybody angry. I still have some money from the experience. I'm not going to be in a trailer park anytime soon, and I'm very happy for the experience and. In some ways, I'm really quite happy that I didn't become some mega billionaire from the experience, because I've been able to go on and create other companies and grow and learn and become a much better engineer and better manager, leader, builder of companies. And I don't know that I would have had the same incentive to do that if we had simply gone on and become Google-sized or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs. A gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Switching horses here a bit, I wanted to get back to you personally a little bit, because there's so many basic features of browser technology and web technology that, you know, you had a hand in and you were there for, proxying, SSL, that sort of thing. But a couple in particular... you've become, as you put it, somewhat infamous for the browser cookie.
Yeah. I guess you want me to talk about cookies then.
I mean, a little bit. I mean, you know, people have hated advertising on the internet from day one, but it's, you know, obviously we couldn't have gotten to this place if we didn't have advertising and the cookie in your blog post that you have about it, it was a really thoughtful way that you did it. Like, you put a lot of thought into it when you first came up with it. And, you know, I don't know, some of the articles make it seem like it's, you know, some sort of albatross or something, but, you know, somebody had to do it, and you did it in a thoughtful way, I think.
Yeah, we certainly cared a lot about privacy, and there had been a lot of discussion about other mechanisms for adding state to the web. And so when I designed cookies, it was really with the thought that we're going to try to add some state to the web, but as protected as we possibly can of our privacy across the web. So cookies would enable us to have a memory so that when we return to sites, we can interact with that site in a way that it remembers us and can have a much richer interaction, but at the same time wanted to protect against the tracking across all websites through the sharing of unique IDs. As is well publicized, we weren't able to achieve all those goals. Some amount of tracking was enabled by essentially having a whole bunch of websites work with other centralized websites to do this collection. But also, as I've said in other blog posts and such, in pretty much any model that you have some sort of memory, and I would preface that this by saying that some amount of memory is absolutely necessary for a reasonable experience on the web. So any model which introduces memory will suffer from that same problem, i.e. the ability to collect some amount of information in the future. So there isn't really any way to get away from this except get rid of all the features that we know and love about the web. So we have to deal with this problem in some way. And cookies give the power, much of the power, back to the user, so that the users who really care about strong privacy protections can go in and change their settings and change how their web browser works so that they can take control back. And you know, one of the things that I would say is that good technology stands the test of time, and you know, people have looked at cookies and examined cookies and tried to come up with better alternatives for 20 years, and it's still the same old cookie, meaning that nobody's come up with anything better yet. And I've thought about it a lot, and there are some minor improvements we could make, but the basic fundamental tenet of the cookie is still a good one. And people get a ton of benefits from it.
No, I think you actually, like I said, I thought it was a reasonable argument that you made in that blog post, which I'll put a link to that on the post page as well. But answer for the blink tag.
Well, I think my blog post kind of says it all. We came up with it as kind of a funny thing, and then. It was introduced by the other engineers as an Easter egg, a functional Easter egg, unfortunately. The functional Easter egg leaked out, and people started using it. So clearly there was some demand there, although not necessarily enjoyed by all. We did finally give you the ability to turn blink off and that sort of thing. But yeah, it was kind of a funny joke that got a little out of control.
I kind of agreed with a commenter that blink wasn't nearly as annoying as the marquee. You remember that? The marquee tags? Yeah.
And... Well, you know, all those things eventually culminated in the invention of the animated GIF.
That's funny that you say that. I was going to bring that up too. How were you involved with that? Like, making that a standard in the browser, or what was the deal there?
So we had decided to add Java into the browser as a kind of standard feature. That's basically a plugin that was included with the browser. And Java had all this great promise as being something like running code within the browser in a sandboxed, safe environment. The problem was Java at that time had a horrible implementation and took about 30 seconds to boot just to like start up. So if any Java app comes in a web page, 30 seconds later, the Java app starts up after grinding your computer to a complete halt. So it was not a particularly wonderful experience. And I found as I was surfing the web after Java was released, it seemed like the only purpose that people were using Java for at the time was to put scrolling banner ads and flashing things up above content so that people would notice the banner ad. And I was just really annoyed that every time I went to a web page, it would take 30 seconds for the thing to start up, and it was killing my computer. So I remember having this conversation with the guy who is writing our imaging code, Scott Furman, and he had told me that GIFs had this ability to do this kind of animation thing, and it was really cool, and he showed me how this could work. And at the time, I was like, oh, this is awesome. We should put it in. He was like, nah, nobody wants it. You know, it's a lot of work. We'd have to do all these things. And so we kind of let it go. And then when I saw Java was only doing basically these stupid animations and it was killing my computer, I went back over to Scott and I said, Scott, we got to do this. And he was resistant. And I just kept going every day. And every time I would see Java come up, I'd be like, Scott, we got to do this. We got to do this. We got to do this. So after about a month of pestering, he finally relented and built the animated GIF code into the browser for the next release. And essentially, all that Java disappeared in one release because everybody said, "Oh, this is a much better way to do banner ads." So
yeah, that's funny. Every ad that we ran for 3 years were animated GIFs.
Exactly. And so it was really my anger at the bad implementation of Java that caused me to just go insane on that thing. So in some ways, it probably killed Java because it created less incentive to go fix Java to be faster because people stopped using it essentially. Although that's really we were just incorporating Sun's code. If they had just gotten around to making Java a little bit faster, the Java interpreter, it probably would have been fine. But since they never got around to doing that, Java pretty much died as a client-side language on the web. And we were also working on JavaScript, which did all the things that Java kind of hoped to do within the browser.
Well, could you possibly have imagined the afterlife that the animated GIF has had these days? You know, where would Reddit be without it?
Exactly. It's a fun meme. I love animated GIFs most of the time. It's nice to see that we don't have all those quite as annoying advertisements as they used to be with the craziness that the early days brought. And now that we have video formats and everything else, we've gone beyond what the animated GIF originally set out to do.
Right. Is the Fish Cam still running?
I think
that it was.
If you go to fishcam.com, you can see it. I'll go wave in the camera after we're done.
Okay.
And we're coming up on the 20-year anniversary. I think the Fish Cam first went live. Gosh, I don't know, somewhere in August, September kind of time frame of 1994. So I don't know what I'm going to do for the 20-year anniversary there, but something fun.
Well, that segs me easily to my final Good Morning America-style puff questions for you, which are essentially, it is 20 years now. I feel like I want to ask all you guys that were there at the beginning of this sort of stuff, like, what is the web and the internet what you were envisioning at the time? Are you disappointed by what it's become? Is it more than you could have imagined? Is it exactly what you imagined?
Well, it's certainly way beyond what I could have imagined, because the way people have used it in businesses that are completely transformed now, I never would have imagined. The idea at the founding of the company was to create a platform where people could do things that were extraordinary and way beyond what we could think of. We would actually sit in meetings and say, okay, that's a good feature, but how do we make it so people could do stuff that we can't even imagine? Let's not limit this to our own imagination. Let's make the building blocks capable of building something way beyond. So make sure it fits together like Legos. It was partly the design of cookies was made more general than it needed to be so that people could do more with it than just what I was imagining. And the design of JavaScript and the design of our HTML elements were designed to create building blocks that could be built into something that was extraordinary. And I'm unbelievably proud of what we were able to create. If you look back at the history, the time period between 1994 and 1995, when we started in about the first 2 years of our development, essentially every major piece of technology which drives the web today was invented in that time period by a relatively small group of very passionate engineers. And I'm just I'm humbled and I just overjoyed that I was able to be part of such a special team that worked really, really hard to create the initial technology that has exploded into something so amazing.
Does it feel like it's been 20 years, or this coming up, is it coming up faster than you would have imagined, or what does it feel like that it's 20 years on now?
It definitely doesn't feel like 20 years. I sometimes wonder where all the time has gone. I've been enjoying my life and trying to do as many things as possible, and I can't believe 20 years has gone by. I've recently seen several of the founding team members, and we don't look that different, honestly. I guess maybe that's just a matter of perspective. But
you never look that different when you look in the mirror, do you?
No.
You still see the 10-year-old or something looking back at you.
Yeah. Everybody's doing well, and I saw spent a bunch of time with Jim recently, and he's unbelievably vibrant. He's expecting a second child and living life to its fullest. We have these amazing conversations and talk about it. We don't focus on the past a lot. We're thinking about, you know, what would be another great company to start? How is mobile technology transforming, you know, our lives and various things, and just new ideas and loving where the world is and where it can go.
Well, that sounds like a good place to end. You're at Zeta.net now, correct?
Absolutely.
And just a little bit about Zeta for us.
We are a leading provider of offsite data protection and disaster recovery services for small to medium enterprises.
Excellent. Well, I'll let you get back to that. My thanks definitely to Lou Montulli for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
My thanks again to Lou, and just a quick note here to let you know to stay tuned. Over the next few weeks, we'll have hopefully plenty more early Netscape folk.